You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Milwaukee high school is headed to the Robotics World Championship. We'll talk to their coach and a student driver for the team coming up next. First, it's now legal to grow industrial hemp here in Wisconsin with a permit. The legislature passed a hemp legalization bill unanimously, and Governor Scott Walker signed it into law last year. Now the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection is accepting license applications for the state's first industrial hemp growing season in a long time. State Senator Patrick Teston was one of the bill's sponsors in the Senate. He's a Republican representing Wisconsin's 24th State Senate District, which includes Stevens Point. Senator Teston, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great to be here.
All right, so if I'm a farmer and I'm hearing about this hemp pilot project, I want to get on board. How do I get started?
Well, first, you're going to want to contact the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. And first and foremost, before anyone wants to get involved in the growing of industrial hemp, you want to make sure that you have a buyer lined up at the end of the season. Because the worst thing that we can do after reintroducing this crop for the first time in the state in over 70 years is to create a market where there's no demand at the end of the growing season. So find a buyer first and then contact DATCAP to go through the registration process, the licensing process to get registered to grow it. And then from there, hopefully once the snow melts, we'll have our first season of ground since, I believe, 1957.
And we used to be the state for hemp production, right?
We were. We were one of the national leaders, one of the world leaders, in fact. And unfortunately, because of its close relation to the marijuana plant, it got lumped in with that. And unfortunately, we haven't been able to grow it for decades. But thanks to the 2014 Farm Bill that was signed into law by President Obama, it gives states the leeway to set up and establish pilot programs. And so since then, over 30 states have reintroduced this crop, including our neighbors in Michigan, Minnesota, and Illinois. Now, thankfully, we're back. We're going to be able to grow industrial hemp again because there's so many different uses and applications for this this plant that I really see it as a future commodity. And especially at a time when our farmers are really struggling right now with low commodity prices in corn and soy, we see this as an opportunity for them to diversify their portfolios and hopefully add this into their crop rotations and lessen our dependence on a foreign import, which we import about $600 million of industrial hemp from other countries like China and Canada every single year.
So there are buyers out there. There's demand domestically for more hemp production?
Absolutely. Demands from the textile industry to food processors. I mean, you can go into major grocery stores right now and you can find things like hemp hearts and hemp seeds. They're putting hemp seeds into things like granola bars. It was pretty neat when we had the public hearing last year in the state Senate. We had a hemp farmer from Kentucky come up who has been advocating for this on the national level as well as going state to state. And she brought up a basket of products, everything from soap to rope to some of the food that you can make with this. And then for Wisconsin, we're known to like a drink or two, and she even brought up a jar of Kentucky moonshine that was made from distilled hemp seeds. So, I mean, there's so many different applications for this plant that I really see this when we look back 5-10 years from now. I think Wisconsin's going to be a national leader once again.
Let's take a step back here, because I think still some people might hear hemp and think hemp equals marijuana. They're synonyms of the same thing. Compare and contrast a little bit for us.
Sure. And I was one of those. When I was first approached by State Representative Jesse Kramer to be the Senate lead on this legislation, I had some serious concerns initially because I thought anytime we talked about hemp, we were talking about marijuana. And he said, no, Senator, this is not what you think it is. And so I had that misconception, so I had to go out and educate myself. And as I researched this, I realized, well, there's not enough THC in this plant to cause the high effect that you get from the marijuana plant. And in fact, our legislation dictates that it can't go above 0.3% THC concentration. So I often tell people and some of the cynics out there who thought this is the slippery slope that if you wanted to try and get high from industrial hemp, you'd have to smoke a whole 40-acre field and it's still not going to get the job done, and you're going to have a really bad headache. And in fact, in other states where they have legalized marijuana, they've actually codified in state statutes that you can't grow industrial hemp within so many miles of a marijuana grow operation because when they cross-pollinate, the industrial hemp pollinates so quickly that it actually dilutes the THC concentration in the marijuana plant. And so That was probably our biggest challenge, was educating some of our colleagues who had some concerns. I remember initially when we first discussed it in the Republican caucus, there were a number of my colleagues who were in the same boat that I was originally. And so as we educated my colleagues and Representative Kramer in the assembly, we got to a point where it was ready, and it passed unanimously out of both houses, which if you would have told me at the start of this process that this was going to pass both the state assembly and the state senate unanimously, I would have said you're crazy. But we got the job done, and thanks to Governor Walker for signing the law, and now it's a reality.
Talking to State Senator Patrick Teston about Wisconsin's new hemp pilot program. So getting back to the practical elements here, once that farmer gets that license to have this pilot program, it's not a done deal yet. There are reporting requirements and potential inspection requirements. Is that right?
Right. So what's unique about this whole situation is because at the federal level, we're kind of at a unique crossroads between federal regulations versus state regulations. So the industrial hemp, for anyone who wants to grow, is the only crop in Wisconsin where you're going to have to pass a background check, which we had to do that to get support from stakeholders like law enforcement as well as the Department of Justice. So once people go through the application process, they will have to do some annual reports because, as dictated under the 2014 Farm Bill, states have to research this. They have to set up pilot programs. Now, our hope is that there is currently federal legislation working its way through. Congressman Comer out of Kentucky has a bill that would take industrial hemp off the controlled substance list. Now, if that were to pass and become law, all the reporting, all the background checks, the GPS coordinates that you have to provide to the Department of Agriculture go away, which is certainly our hope, because we understood early on that this was going to be a process. And as much as we'd like to remove some of the government restrictions, in order to get to where we are today, we had to make some concessions.
I understand there's some gray area on the fringes here, especially when it comes to purchasing those initial seeds.
Yeah, so they have to be a certified seed. Thankfully, one of the gentlemen who helped us craft this legislation is by the name of Ken Anderson, a Wisconsin native, who has certified Ayahuasca industrial hemp seeds. And so he's really excited because now he's actually going to be able to do business in his home state, whereas before he's had to go around the country. And so there are certified seed dealers out there like Ken Anderson of Legacy Hemp, and there are others as well. So it boils down to the fact that if you are interested in growing this crop, you need to contact individuals like that to make sure that, one, you can get the certified seed that you need, and then also get hooked up with a processor at the end of the growing cycle.
I understand that, I don't know if this is still true, at some point it would have been easier to buy seeds from Canada or Europe than to take them across state lines if you went to another state to buy seeds.
Yeah, it's one of those weird, some of the bureaucratic nuances of this and some of the regulations, which, again, was one of the challenges that we really had. And that's why we did our due diligence in the craft in this legislation to have what we believe is one of the strongest pilot programs for industrial hemp in the country, where other states have been rather vague or, in our opinion, went above what federal law allows. I think we achieve that balancing act of making sure that we're compliant with what the feds allow, but also making sure that we have strict standards here in the state of Wisconsin for the reintroduction of this crop.
I understand members of both parties in Wisconsin's congressional delegation are on board with changing some of those federal laws.
Yeah, you have Congressman Grothman to Congressman Mark Polkan, two individuals that I think everyone can agree on are on polar ends of the political spectrum, have come together and signed on to the federal legislation, which it's really exciting because this is, I truly believe this is a big win for farmers, not just in Wisconsin, but across the country. I mean, it's one of those issues where we can set partisan politics aside and do what's best for our hardworking farmers and make sure that our $88 billion agriculture industry here in the state of Wisconsin continues to grow and prosper and hopefully go above that $88 billion into the future.
Yeah, there's no such thing as a miracle crop that's going to magically save all the farmers. But 10 years from now, what are you hoping to see?
I'm hoping to see that Wisconsin is the number one producer of industrial hemp in the country again. And what's so great about this crop, it's one, it's a weed. So, I mean, it's not a high water intensive crop. You don't have to use any pesticide applications because of the canopy that develops, ensures that no weeds underneath it can take over the field. So it's really one of those crops that low maintenance, we've proven that we've grown it in the past. So I truly do believe that Wisconsin will be a national leader once again in the industrial hemp market.
Senator Teston, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Senator Patrick Teston is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 24th State Senate District, which includes Stevens Point. He was with us to talk about the rollout of the state's new industrial hemp program. Now, a Milwaukee High School robotics team is headed to the Robotics World Championships in Detroit. It's the Riverside University High School RoboTigers, a team that was rated as an underdog before they won at regionals last month in lacrosse. Chris Levis is an administrator at Milwaukee's Riverside University High School and head coach of the Riverside Robo Tigers. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. And Ilim Fernandez is a driver for the Robo Tigers. Ilim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, how excited is the team to be headed to Detroit for the championships?
Oh, they're extremely excited. We have about 30 kids on the team, and all of them are ready to go compete on a world championship level. We're extremely excited. I can't say anything else about that.
Ilim, what do you do as your job as a driver for the team?
Well, basically, my job is to create strategies with other teams, pay attention to what everybody does, and just drive the robot, do my best.
So, Chris, what do the students who are on the team do? What all is involved in this robot project?
So basically the team gets about 6 weeks to build a 140-pound competition robot to do multiple tasks. So it's like a giant chess game that every team has to strategize and figure out how to best play that chess match. Our team designs, creates those CAD drawings of what our robot wants or of what a robot is, and then what they do is they do pneumatics, electrical systems, they do mechanical systems, computer programming. There's a whole gamut of every single type of engineering you can think of that our kids are doing to build the robot in the 6 weeks. And if you don't build it in the 6 weeks, you're kind of out of luck.
And Chris, does the team know what the tests are going to be before they go to this championship, or do you have to make it versatile for you don't know what?
Yeah, no, the team knows what the tasks will be. So there's multiple regional competitions after the 6 weeks build season, and every regional game is exactly the same. The championship game will be exactly the same as the regional games. So we have our strategy of how we want to play that game. We have a robot to manipulate the pieces the way we want it to be manipulated, and we're going to go in there and hopefully knock some heads.
Ilim, when you've gone through this process, you've designed this robot, tweaked it, worked it all out, what are you thinking as you're about to go through the course and actually put it to the test?
Well, I'm thinking about how the robot's going to work, how I'm going to be adjusting to it, and also like all the problems we can face in the competitions and how I can work with it with my team.
And do you feel nervous as you start to roll? Like, what's going to happen with all the hard work you just put in?
Yeah, I feel really nervous at the beginning because I really don't know how is this going to work, how I'm going to work with the robot, drive it, and, if I'm going to do good or not.
Chris, let's meet the robot. It's called Valentina. Do I have that right?
That is correct. They named it with the other students.
And this, I looked at a picture. It almost looks like a moving, guillotine or something. Tell us a little bit about how this came together.
Well, the robot has to grab these cubes from the playing field and manipulate the cubes. The cubes are about the size of an egg crate. And they have to put the cubes on a series of different switches, which are basically balances on the floor, and then a giant scale, which is about 7-ish feet off the ground. So the robot has to pick up the cubes on the bottom, which are the little arm intake things that you see on the bottom. And then the guillotine device is what we call the elevator. It basically is a machine that lifts the whole egg crate cube up and drops it onto the top of the scale.
Okay.
And then you maximize your points by doing that.
Ilim, Valentina has a name. Do you and the other students feel like Valentina has a kind of a personality?
Yeah, it really does.
Like what? How would you, if Valentina were a person, how would you describe it?
Well, we name it because it has this girly name also, and then at the same time a man. So it's also aggressive on the field, but also we can be gentle with it. So it has different personalities at the same time when we're on the field and we're in the practice field.
Chris, I know not every high school has a robotics team. How did this get started there?
We started the program about 10 years ago with one of our math teachers here, Ulysses Sepúlveda. 8 years ago, I started working with him and became the head coach of the team. It's basically sponsored by Rockwell Automation and GE Healthcare, along with George Mosher Foundation and MSOE. They supply us with the funds to buy all the equipment for the kids, and they also supply us with sponsors. So all of our other coaches are actual engineers who come in and work with our kids. So the program's been really successful because we're a student-driven program, and the mentors come in from outside of Milwaukee Public Schools and work with our kids. So yeah, that's pretty much the story of how we got started.
Lynn, when I was in high school, I think the most high-tech project I built was a toothpick bridge. I hated doing that. Is this robot project fun?
Yeah, this is not just like a robotics club. This is also like about learning all the strategies, learning about like math, science, and also like what you can create using your imagination and working with others.
And Lynn, do you see yourself maybe going into some kind of career that evolves? Maybe it's robotics or some kind of engineering or related field?
So I'm thinking between medicine or going to biomedical engineering.
And Chris, is that part of the hope that you've got a bunch of kids, they're doing this stuff, and maybe they're setting their sights on scientific or engineering or medical fields that they might not have considered before?
Yeah, that's it. We are an inner city school, and we have a great, huge diversity of students here. A lot of our students come to our school and want to do STEM and get into the robotics program, and they get real excited when they get to work with an engineer. And I think the relationship they build with the engineers that we have working with our kids kind of pushes students to broaden their horizons and look into STEM fields. Actually, multiple students that we have currently on the team have internships at Rockwell Automation. One of our graduates who's a continuing mentor, we have two graduates who graduated from Riverside and they continue to mentor our team. They're both interned at Rockwell Automation. One of those students is actually getting paid for by Rockwell to go live in China and work with a Chinese Rockwell Automation team for a summer. So we're definitely seeing outcomes from this program. I believe six of our past seven graduates are all in university school, four-year universities, and on the STEM track to do some kind of engineering, mechanical, or electrical.
And Chris, where can we watch for the results from next week in Detroit?
If you actually Google FIRST Robotics and click on the main webpage there, you can see they have live streams from the FIRST Robotics webpage.
Chris, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Lynn, good luck next week.
Thank you.
Been talking to Chris Levis and Aylin Fernandez with the Riverside University Robo Tigers. We were talking to them as they gear up for the Robotics World Championship in Detroit next week. First, according to our next guest, the three largest providers of mental health care in America are not hospitals, but jails in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. And in her words, they are hopelessly ill-equipped for the job. She talked with current and former prisoners and their families, healthcare providers, lawyers, and police and corrections officers. She found that people with mental illness often face solitary confinement, inadequate mental health care, and violence, sometimes at the hands of jail and prison employees. Alisa Roth is a print and radio reporter in New York. Her new book is Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. Alisa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with a quote in your book. This is from an open letter from Sheriff Tom Dart in Cook County, Illinois, to other sheriffs and jail directors. He wrote, "Absolutely none of us signed up to run the largest mental health institutions in our respective communities, yet that is where we find ourselves." That's what's happening around the country, that jails are the biggest mental health care providers?
That is correct. We have ever more people with mental illness ending up in the criminal justice system. By some counts, as many as 50% of people in our jails and prisons have a mental illness. And the wardens and corrections officers are left with this job of taking care of people with mental illness.
I want to talk about how we got here. And a common story I've heard is deinstitutionalization. We used to have these mental health care facilities. People were appalled at the conditions there. We tried to get people out of them. Now we have this problem. You say it's more complicated than that.
It is. The deinstitutionalization story is a lovely one, in part because it has this very simple solution. If the problem is that people aren't getting the mental health care they need that's causing them to commit crimes and end up in jail or prison, then all we have to do is treat that mental illness and they'll stop ending up in the criminal justice system. I argue that this is really part of the story of mass incarceration, that we're locking up ever more people, so we're we're picking up more people with mental illness. At the same time, very particular pieces of that mass incarceration story, so for example, the war on drugs, is contributing to this problem. So a large number of people with mental illness, particularly those who are incarcerated, also have a substance use disorder. So if you're arresting large numbers of people for having drugs, for using drugs, for selling drugs, it stands to reason that you're also going to be arresting a lot of people with mental illness. Likewise, the things like broken windows policing, where we try to crack down on small crimes as a way of preventing larger crimes, ends up picking up a lot of people who are, say, homeless, sleeping on the sidewalk, or being loud and drunk in public.
I want to take this a couple steps along the path here. One problem that you write about, and we've heard about this happening in Milwaukee and elsewhere in Wisconsin, is that when a person is having a critical mental health episode and police are called, they might not want to take them to jail, but they often don't have another option. The only options might be the emergency room or a jail. There's not an emergency mental health system.
Let's start with something you said. I just want to call attention to that.
Sure.
When somebody's having a mental health crisis and the police are called, so if we're having any other kind of a health crisis, a heart attack, a stroke, a low sugar incident as a diabetic, we call 911 and we get an ambulance. But in 99% of the cases, when somebody's having a mental health crisis, it's the police who show up because, as you say, we don't have an emergency mental health care system. And then once the police come, even if the police are able to defuse the situation, they're able to talk to this person and not have it deteriorate into some kind of a standoff or a violent situation between the police officer and this person who's having the crisis, the police simply have no place to take them. Going to the emergency room, as anybody who's been to an emergency room knows, can be hours and hours of sitting there. The police don't want to be doing that. Their bosses don't want them to be doing that. There's really no place to take them.
Talking to Elisa Roth, her new book is Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. And now let's look at the jails. First of all, people with mental illness, you write, likely to spend longer periods of time there than people without. Why is that happening?
There's a whole series of things that happen that mean that people with mental illness stay in jail longer than other people. We can start with bail. People with mental illness are less likely to be able to make bail, and when they do, it takes them longer to get that bail, so it takes them longer to get out. Judges are often anxious about letting somebody go. There's this idea that people with mental illness are dangerous, and the judges, I've heard judges say over and over, you don't want to be that person who ends up on the front page of the paper because you let that person out on bail and he went and committed another crime. And then there's the whole question of competency to stand trial. If a person, we don't allow people to go before a judge or to stand in court if they are not sane. This is a logical, reasonable thing. But if somebody is found incompetent to stand trial, that is too insane to be in court, then he or she needs to be sent to be restored to sanity. And there are very long wait times to be tested in many places to even determine whether somebody is sane enough to stand trial. And then once that person is found incompetent to stand trial, there's often a very, very long wait for a treatment spot so that person can be restored. So there's a whole host of reasons that people with mental illness may stay longer in jail and in prison.
And that takes us into jail and prison and a lot of what you focus on in the book. What happens then when a person with a serious mental illness is in jail and prison and they don't have access to, as you say, the very few available beds for treatment there?
Well, let's start with the fact that that people who are in jail or prison are the only group in the United States who have a constitutional right to health care. And that includes mental health care. So people who are in jail or prison should be receiving mental health care in while they're incarcerated. But often there are just simply aren't enough resources to treat them properly. And on top of it, jails and prisons are simply not therapeutic environments. It's very, very difficult to treat somebody for mental illness in that environment. On top of that, we have corrections officers who are the primary people who are responsible for the care of these people. And they are, in most cases, simply not trained to deal with mental illness. So they're not trained to recognize the symptoms. They're not trained to know how to respond to a crisis. And what ends up happening all too often is that somebody with a mental illness misbehaves. Jails and prisons are scary places, even if you're sane. But if you don't know what's going on, they can be truly terrifying places. They have a lot of rules and regulations, some of which can feel very capricious. You know, you need to stand at a certain time to be counted, or you need to be in a certain spot to receive your food tray. People with mental illness are sometimes just simply incapable, because of their disease, incapable of following the rules. They end up getting in trouble and often end up as a result in solitary confinement. Solitary confinement, we have seen over and over and over again, can trigger mental illness, or in people who already have it, can exacerbate the symptoms. So it really ends up being this sort of vicious cycle of symptoms and misbehavior and punishment, and symptoms and misbehavior and punishment.
We're talking to Elisa Roth about what she calls America's criminal treatment of mental illness. That's the subtitle of her new book, Insane. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Has someone, maybe in your family, maybe you yourself, had this experience dealing with mental illness in a jail or prison setting? Have you worked in jail and prison or in mental health care? What do you see going on in your field? What questions do you have about for our guest about how people with mental illnesses are treated in the correctional system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Elisa Roth is with us, journalist in New York, author of the new book, Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in the correctional system? Do you see problems with mental illness there? Is the system as we have it in Wisconsin and the United States broken? Have you or someone in your family been on the other side of this, maybe as an inmate dealing with mental health concerns? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls now, Ray is with us in Rhinelander. Ray, hi.
Hi. I can see the evolution of this problem, which started in the 80s when our President Ronald Reagan switched the health care systems and got rid of a lot of rehab programs, and the pharmacology changed, rehab, et cetera. I worked in the criminal justice system. I worked for the feds. I worked for the state, worked for county. I was a criminal psychologist. I saw this evolution go on and on and on. And right now, you're right. Our law enforcement people are basically the mental health stabilizing police. There's not much of a choice for them. Everything is dumped on them. We don't have specific mental health rehab centers. We don't have acute care. I can use all the fancy words, et cetera, et cetera. We just do not have the present state in health care to deal with these things. And in the prison system, they have separate mental health units, they have behavioral health units, they have a variety of different things. But you're right. The guards end up being the stabilized.
Ray, thanks for the call. Elisa, what are your thoughts?
It's true. One of the really big problems is accessing mental health care in the community. It's gotten to the point where there is so little accessibility that people are coming in. For example, what I saw in Oklahoma, people are coming in saying they need mental health care, or saying that their family member needs mental health care, and being told, you know, effectively, come back unless you are actively psychotic or actively suicidal. We simply don't have the capacity to deal with people who are less severely symptomatic.
Ray, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Scott in Sturgeon Bay. Scott, hi.
Hi. I am just wondering if the guest and author has a proposed solution. Is it to reestablish state-funded mental health facilities, or what are her thoughts regarding the answer to this dilemma?
Alisa?
I think that providing more mental health care in the communities would be a great place to start. I think we also need to really think about how we deal with the criminal justice system. As I said, I think this is really part of the story of mass incarceration. We're seeing in some places, in a lot of places, let me say, police officers being trained in how to respond to a mental health care crisis. So acknowledging that these police officers are going to be the first responders. We're seeing more diversion programs. So when somebody is picked up by the police, finding ways to get them out of the criminal justice system and into treatment, whether before or after they're charged with a crime. We're finding that cities, San Antonio is a good example of this, are building crisis centers so that police have some place to take somebody in a crisis rather than taking them to jail.
Time for one more caller. Mike is with us in Oconomowoc. Mike, hi.
Yeah, I was just saying I'm a physician. I have had some patients who've been in jail and talked with some physicians who've worked in jails. And I know there are restrictions on medications for mental health that overlap, that they're just not allowed to use, not allowed to treat ADD or restless leg syndrome with certain medications like gabapentin, which have a lot of coexistence. And I almost feel it's just really not fair to the patients who are going through that not to get that treated. And the doctors themselves are just handicapped. They're handcuffed. They can't.
Mike, thanks on bringing Lisa. And have you encountered that in other places around the country, restrictions on the kind of medications that can be used?
Absolutely. And sometimes it has to do with the cost of the medication, which we see out in the community, of course, as well. Insurance may or may not agree to pay for a certain medication. There are also certain medications. There's concerns that they may be traded on the black market inside the jail or prison. And so those are outlawed. It's a tricky question.
Mike, thanks a lot for your call. Alisa, you talk to a lot of people, family members, people who run jails, healthcare providers, a lot of people who recognize that there is a problem. Is there a consensus among the people who are involved here that we're doing things wrong here?
It was one of the most interesting things I found in reporting this book is that across the board from the political spectrum, across the board in terms of you're talking about the district attorneys, you know, the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, the sheriffs, the police officers, the families, everybody seems to agree that we're doing this wrong. The question is figuring out how to do it right.
Right. Does that consensus seem to be motivating any kind of action to change the system in a fundamental way?
I think there's a lot of action. I think we're seeing more and more police departments are doing training. I think that more and more jails and prisons are training their corrections officers. As a caller said, more and more prisons are building behavioral health units. So there is absolutely this acknowledgement that this is a problem, that we need to somehow respond to that problem. My hope is that we can figure out a way to resolve the problem before people are ending up in the criminal justice system, rather than only responding by making the criminal justice system more friendly to people with mental illness.
It sounds like this would take a pretty significant investment to create this alternative system so that jails aren't the mental health providers of default. Do you get a sense that people are willing to make that kind of investment?
I think in some cases they are. I think there, if you stop and look at the numbers, incarceration is expensive, and incarcerating people with mental illness is particularly expensive because there's the cost of the medications, there's the cost of extra officers, all sorts of things. So if we really stop and look at those numbers, I think there's a good argument to be made that an ounce of prevention may be worth a pound of cure here.
We'll leave it there. Alisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Alisa Roth, a print and radio reporter in New York. We talked with her about her new book, Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this issue. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or post your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tributes to former Wisconsin Secretary of State Vel Phillips came from many people today after news surfaced that the Milwaukee civil rights icon died last night at age 94. Chuck Kornbach has more about Phillips' life and reactions to her passing.
Vel Phillips blazed a lot of trails. She was the first African-American woman to graduate from the UW-Madison Law School, doing so in 1951. 5 years later, she was elected to the Milwaukee Common Council, becoming the first African-American woman to take office. In the 1960s, she spent years advocating for the city's first fair housing ordinance. As reported in a 2015 Wisconsin Public Television documentary, Phillips spoke her mind one of the many times her fellow council members rejected the measure.
It's bad enough to have to deal with the bigot, but when you got a dumb bigot.
Eventually, the Fair Housing Ordinance passed, and Phillips went on to new heights, first African-American judge in Wisconsin, and in 1978, she became the first African-American elected to statewide office. She served 4 years as Secretary of State. Phillips told WPR in 2004 that a lot of pressure goes along with being a trailblazer.
It's tough. And when you're a double whammy, like I was, the first woman and the first African-American, it's not easy at all. And there were many nights that, you know, you just cry yourself to sleep, but you keep going.
And go Phillips did, continuing to take part in various protests and speaking up on issues. In 2014, when she turned 90, Phillips urged the Milwaukee Common Council to support a controversial streetcar plan for the city.
I just think it would be wonderful to have a streetcar going up and down Wisconsin. Our downtown is getting very, you know, not too many people there. And
several of the alderpersons in the Common Council chambers when Phillips spoke gathered today in the Milwaukee City Hall Rotunda to remember her. Among them, Alderwoman Malele Coggs, who yesterday helped create a Vel Phillips Trailblazer Award.
We decided to go ahead and do the award in the timing that we did because of a strong belief people should get their flowers while they're living.
Coggs says, ironically, Phillips died a few hours later. But as the alderwoman told reporters, Phillips's lessons will live on. Coggs says when she was sworn in 2008, she went with Phillips to City Hall and learned she had Phillips's old office.
That she was in that office primarily because her white male counterparts did not want an office share with her because everybody else shared an office. But she took pride in having that office to herself. It made me sit 4 years in that office, the smallest office down here, with a little bit of pride.
African-American males on the Milwaukee Common Council say Vel Phillips helped them, too. Alderman Russell Stamper II says his father often worked with Phillips on an African-American forum called Community Brainstorming. When the younger Stamper took office 4 years ago, he got some advice.
You got to go see Vel Phillips. That's the first thing you got to do if you want to succeed.
But for all of Phillips being a role model, there still hasn't been a second African-American elected to statewide office. UW-Milwaukee Governmental Affairs Professor Mordecai Lee says barriers fall slowly.
In other words, are there still some voters out there to whom somebody's either sexual orientation or race or whatever it might be would be disqualifying? I suspect that in Wisconsin there are some old-fashioned voters like that, but it's so much less than it was 50 years ago. And it's thanks to people like Vel Phillips that it's so much less.
Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm says Phillips' son, Michael, is an assistant DA with the county and continues his mother's work for justice. Chuck Quirnbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll check out the latest on the U.S. Supreme Court and immigration with action on the travel ban, deportations, and more. Plus, we'll look at Neil Gorsuch, President Trump's Supreme Court appointee, who sided with liberals on a deportation issue, and speculation about the possible retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy and what that might mean for the court and a future nominee. We'll look at a report on eminent domain and how it's being used to clear the way for the Foxconn development. We'll look at this incident at a Starbucks in Philadelphia and what it says about race relations in the United States and some of the everyday ways that African Americans feel they're treated when they go out in public. And we'll have some fun. This one goes to 11, and it's so fetch. We'll look at the movies that change the way we talk. And you can start participating in that conversation right now. Tweet us at CentralTimeWPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Here's the question. Is there a movie, a comedy, or otherwise that added a phrase or word to your daily language, a catchphrase maybe that you kept using maybe for years and years? Tell us about the movie, share that phrase with us, and let us know if you've been driving people crazy by saying it again and again ever since you've seen the movie. All that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.